To order. Ag, Environment, Natural Resources, Finance Committee brought to order. We have a quorum and we'll have minutes of March 23rd for approval. Representative Cornish moves approval of those minutes. Any additions or corrections? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion barely prevails. First we have up is House File 196, Representative Solberg. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for scheduling this 196 bill. 196 is a bill that asks to appropriate $130,000 each year in the biennium to help fund the Mississippi Headwaters Board. The Mississippi Headwaters Board is created in the late 70s in response to the federal government taking over or attempting to take over, suggesting to take over the control of the Upper Mississippi River and do all the things for the federal government. Senator Lessard was the leading force at the time, and instead of having the federal government come in, they formed a joint powers board that was charged with protecting the Mississippi River. I think there are seven counties.
There are eight, sir.
Eight counties that are involved in that. It goes from Itasca State Park to Lake Itasca down through Little Falls. And there's always been some state support to make sure that we are protecting the river with their planning and the zoning ordinances. I have with me today, and I met him for the first time, he came down, Robert Sweet Nelson, who is, I believe, a county commissioner from Cass County.
From Hubbard County.
Hubbard County. Well, I told you, I just met him a few minutes ago. And he would like to give some testimony on this, if you may. Sure.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Sweet Nelson, Hubbard County Commissioner. I'm also a board member of the Mississippi Headwaters Board, sir.
If you'd like to present your testimony.
Well, Representative Solberg said, we've been operating since the late 79s and 1980s when we really got formed. It's an eight-county joint powers board who are charged by the statute to the protecting the first 405 miles of the Mississippi River. It's an eight-county joint powers board. We work very well together with our planning and zoning administrators and the ordinance that we have in place of all the counties and the cities along the Mississippi have adopted in order to protect the, I think, the most treasured piece of property of the Mississippi River that this country has. We work with education, with the kids in schools, with Riverwatch, to educate the youth who are leaders of tomorrow to respect the environment that we have and that we're trying to protect, sir.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of a straightforward request for state support for this organization. They also have some local support as well, but I think it's an extremely important cooperative and collaborative and type of investment that we've made over the years and have had that state support. It's kind of interesting also that they have received, I believe, some funds from the Glandon Foundation and are working with some of the school children in the area and are doing some water testing and so forth in the Mississippi River. So it's actually a collaboration between some of the school districts, Mississippi Headwaters Board, and the Glandon Foundation for an education opportunities for young people on the Mississippi River. It was also announced just this last week that as we are dealing with impaired waters, that the Mississippi River in the Grand Rapids area will be taken off the impaired waters list, my understanding. And this is how we, I think, have a long-term effect on making sure we protect Mississippi. It has been extremely positive. I remember the controversy over establishing the Upper Mississippi Headwaters Board. President Carter was a leading force at the time to be have the federal government protect the navigable waters. And when this was being debated in the House floor, Bob Lazard was a senator, and he received a call directly from President Carter to talk about what are you doing in Minnesota. And the federal government under President Carter backed off from them taking control of the Upper Mississippi River with the understanding that this particular planning, local planning, would be in control and in force, and it's proved very, very successful.
Other questions? So, as you know, Representative Solberg, financial times are tight, but the as we're dealing with the Clean Water Legacy Act, this committee will be working on that in the near future. I think this is one of those types of examples of prevention that we need to have some focus on, and to recognize that that also needs to be very much part of that overall activity, and not just cleanup, but also preventing things from getting worse and keeping them, not only getting them off the impairment list, but making sure they don't get back on it somewhere along the line. So it's a very important issue. I'm very pleased that you brought this to us, and we will see what we can do to get some support up there.
Mr. Chairman, that's extremely appreciative. Again, if there's ever been a model of successful inner cooperation between eight counties, and you know that can be very difficult sometimes, this has been one, I think, of the two successes, and some small amount of state support will ensure that success. Appreciate that.
Is there anyone in the audience that wanted to speak for or against House File 196? Okay, House File 196 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill. Thank you very much, Representative Solberg, and thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Chair, maybe it would be kind of interesting to have the Commissioner give you what the in-kind contribution has been for what the counties and what their expenses are for supporting this.
Mr. Chair and members, the in-kind that the Mississippi Headwaters Board, that the county provided last year, was right around $1.4 million to make sure that the Mississippi River stayed clean.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, House File 215, Representative Cornish. Welcome to the committee, and please present your bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, this House File 215 is a DNR enforcement bill, an agency bill, and I think the best way to do it is just run right down the fact sheet that's been provided in your packet from the DNR and just highlight the areas, and then rather than get into them in detail.
Representative Cornish, I think it's really more, is there a fiscal implication that has brought this bill to this committee?
I believe there's a fiscal note, but it isn't due till Friday. Is that right, Director Hamm?
Mr. Chair, Colonel Mike Hamm, Chief Conservation Officer, and members, I believe that the committee has requested a fiscal note, and we're working on that, but we're not finding anything for at least on the cost end.
Okay. As I understand it, was there was some question about that, and I think that you're getting to the point now you're fairly confident there is no fiscal implication to this bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that's correct.
Okay, and so I think, members, it's, unless you have some specific questions on this particular issue, Representative Junkie.
The only question I'd have to Mr. Hamm or to the author, who's paying for the background checks? That's the only fiscal note. I haven't read through the bill. Do you charge the instructor for his own background check or hers, or is the department pick that up? I see there's background checks in here. That would be a fiscal note if it's the department picking it up.
Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie, that will be done at a terminal that is BCA terminal that has been assigned to the Department of Natural Resources since we're a law enforcement division, and there is no charge to the instructor.
And, Mr. Chair, there's no time involved either by your officers? What length of time does it take to do a background check? I mean, is it that easy, that simple? I've seen fiscal notes come through before schools and others wanting to do background checks, and there's always numbers assigned to it. Because of staff time and other mail and all the things you have to go through. Besides, I understand any of us can walk over to BCA and type in the numbers on their computer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie, that is what we do right now. We send a staff person over to the BCA's public terminal. We have been doing that for several years now. And what this bill will allow us to do is to use the BCA's CGIS, the Criminal Justice Information System terminal that sits in our building, and literally the staff person will be walking from upstairs to downstairs. We do roughly, it is in the hundreds of backgrounds that we do, but this language won't increase the number of background checks that we do. It gives us better information. So we don't believe that it would be any different than what we currently are doing.
Mm-hmm. And those costs are already in your budget?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct.
Okay. Yes, Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could one of you tell me what is included under criminal and civil sanctions in 169A? On page 3, it's supposed to be a very, very technical correction. I want to know what it is.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pennis, it is. It allows the courts to forward to both the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Public Safety, which both agencies have on DWI laws. And a few years back, Chapter 169A was recodified, and so that is the DWI piece, and so that's what we're looking at.
Thank you.
Any other questions? President Cornish, I believe this bill has been to all the policy committees, and now we've determined that the costs are not an implication. It will not have to go to Ways and Means. So I believe your motion would be Representative Cornish would move the House File 215 be recommended to pass or referred to the General Register.
Be correct, Mr. Chair.
Any questions on that motion? Anyone in the audience want to testify for or against House File 215? Okay. Members, you've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank
bill
you,
is passed. Thank you very much, Colonel Ham. We Representative Cornish, House File 900.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 900 is another omnibus or agency bill, DNR. And
this has a fiscal note with it, I believe.
Yes, mm-hmm. Chair, and I believe a copy is included in the packet. This, I believe we've already been through the
if you can
policy and GovOps of this.
If you could explain the fiscal.
Not everything has been negative, of course. We've come up with innovative ways to put money in many of our options. For several years, we had a formal technology plan, which we carefully decided all the various hardware and software upgrades we needed and when, and budgeted to meet those needs. Then came the budget cuts, beginning about 40 years ago. The technology plan went right out the window. Uh-huh. Actually, it was
testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Buying what we needed when we needed to do something else. This management style worked fairly well for a long time because, as we all know, we have 10, 11, 12,
13.
However, our fears are becoming reality as we start to have very old equipment that's not our current tasks. The hardware we need to replace is quite justifiable, I think. For example, the 2 share printers we need were last purchased in 1986. Also, we keep getting technology needs we didn't even have a few years ago. Most important of these is security. It takes a lot of software and a lot of staff time to keep up with the latest patches and antivirus programs, both at the server level and the workstation level. Just a few years ago, we didn't even know about Chinese hackers and more than the virus.
iPad with regard to the fee, that now we're going to have a fee for the ELS system, but if they have the fire warden continuing to handle it, that they are not allowed to collect the fee. Is that correct?
Basically, the volunteer fire wardens are volunteers. They're doing this because they want to. It's a service to the people in their township. And we've never had any demand from the fire wardens that they be paid for this service. And so those who want to continue this as volunteers will certainly be supported in that.
We have language in some bills that we've dealt with, probably mostly through training, but we've allowed for instructors to charge up to $5 or up to a certain amount for their services and or materials. What would be the department's response for putting in language that says that a fire warden would have authorization to collect, if they so chose, up to $5 for their service?
Mr. Chairman,
there would be no accounting by the department on that.
I can't speak to that this morning because we haven't actually considered that option. My understanding is that there would be some accountability issues that you know, we already spend of our own funds about $170,000 a year just administering the volunteer system and all of the paperwork and paper permits that go with that. And I imagine there would be some added cost to try to hold the fire wardens accountable for charging proper fees and auditing the numbers of permits they issue and so forth.
I'd request you check into that because I don't think you have any additional costs in checking on instructors to see if they are charging the right fee or not. So I'd be interested in seeing what that is.
Mr. Chairman, we'll look into that and get back to the committee with a written report.
I'm anticipating you're going to need a carrot in this one in order to get it passed through the system. I know it's the governor's initiative, and it's not going to receive resistance from this chair, but I think that you're probably going to find some resistance through the process. You're going to need something additional in this bill to make it worthwhile. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that one of the big differences is if only $1 of the new fee goes to the issuing vendor, and $4 goes to pay for the system. So it's not like the DNR or the vendor are getting that current money. So if we made an exception for the paper permits getting $5, that would actually be five times as much as the ELS vendor is getting. And so the DNR really isn't making money or the vendor on this $5.
It gets them where they want to go, though, Representative Cornish.
Yes.
And it would be up to the local fire warden as to whether they chose to charge a fee or not. And the person, if we had the ELS established, then the individual has an alternative. Right now, they don't have an alternative. Even though it's a free service, it's a limited service because you got to get a hold of the person. So it's to give it more expanse opportunity, I think we may need to be a little more creative than what this bill currently has in it.
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, one additional thought is that the paper permits are only good for 1 to 3 days for the most part. So a person has to procure a permit every time they want to burn, whereas this electronic permit is an annual permit, and a person can burn as many times as they need to. And if a person has a little pile of leaves or brush that they're burning every weekend or several weekends a year, that $5 fee covers that. If they have to pay $1 every time they go to the township fire warden for a permit, it may actually cost them more and may hurt the volunteer system more than help it, because there would be that fee each time they need to get a paper permit.
Okay. I just think you need to consider whether you want an ELS system or you don't. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Zimmer, if someone using Representative Osmond's example couldn't find a warden on a weekend and just decided to burn, what's the penalty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that would be a misdemeanor. It's a violation of the state open burning statutes. I think the penalty... I'm not sure of the dollar amount. Maybe Chief Ham could help me out on this one. It's in the neighborhood of, I think, $75 for a misdemeanor penalty if they're ticketed for that.
All right, thank you.
Representative Erdahl, if you don't have a permit and your burning activity causes some damage to someone else's property, hang on. It's going to cost you a lot. that I think I'm really hoping to get the a system put in place that's more accessible for people. But I think the department has to think about what it is they want to protect with regard to the old system and what they may be willing to give up and let people do what they want to do as far as having fire wardens. And if they, giving them some type of carrot can help move this along, it may be in the better interest of all of us. Any other questions? Mr. Helen?
Mr. Chair, members, I just noticed that in Subdivision 1 there, town fire warden is stricken on lines 17 and 18, and yet when we get into Clause B further down the page where it talks about burning permits and how you get one, that town fire warden on page 2 is crossed out, but fire warden, which is left in Clause 1, is not included in that Clause B to be placed in there. So I'm just wondering if fire warden should be mentioned there also, just for consistency's sake. And I don't know why town fire warden is being stricken, but maybe they don't use that terminology anymore.
Would you like to speak to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Helen. We struck in Clause B under burning permits is what you're referring to. That is a clause that requires a person to show their permit to somebody, and that's an archaic remnant of the times when town fire wardens actually did some enforcement work for us and actually checked permits. So we don't permit them to do that anymore because of the training and the liability issues. We only use certified employees or conservation officers or other peace officers to inspect permits. And so that's just a cleanup as opposed to a change in anything we're doing right now.
Any other questions? Anyone in the audience want to speak for or against House File 901? Okay, House File 901 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Thank you.
House File 1904, Representative Hackford.
Mr. Chairman?
Would it be okay if we took House File 1665 first?
That'd be fine. Representative Hackford moves House File 1665.
Mr. Chairman, this is the appropriations bill for Metropolitan Regional Parks for the operation and maintenance. And today I have with me Mr. John Bondolindi with Anoka County, and he's got a PowerPoint presentation, and I turn it over to Mr. Bondolindi.
Good. Thank you very much, Representative Hackbarth. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you. For the record, I'm John Bondolindi, Director of Parks and Recreation for Anoka County. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning on House File 1665. As in the past, I'm here on behalf of the 10 regional park implementing agencies whose elected boards have taken action in support of House File 1665. Now, this morning I'd like to cover briefly three items related to the bill. First, a brief background on the Metropolitan Regional Park System. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the recent trends in funding for Metropolitan Regional Parks. And then lastly, explain some of the implications that this bill would have on the Metropolitan Regional Park System. In 1974, the state legislature established the Metropolitan Regional Park System under the Metropolitan Parks Act, and it directed the Metropolitan Council to identify land and grant funds to cities, counties, and special park districts to acquire, develop, and manage parkland, which together with state parks and trails will serve the metropolitan area residents and visitors. I do want to emphasize that the Metropolitan Regional System is a companion to the park system in meeting the outdoor recreational needs of the residents of the state of Minnesota, and is in lieu of a state park system in the metropolitan area. In the last 31 years, the system has grown to encompass 52,000 acres. It's grown by about 21,000 acres in the last 31 years. Currently, there are 46 regional parks and park reserves in the metropolitan area. These are large parks between 200 and 5,000 acres in size. There are 6 special recreation features, 22 regional trails, of which 200 miles is currently open. And this system collectively hosts 30.5 million visitors per year, making it one of the most visited tourism destinations in the state of Minnesota. The following is a map that illustrates the location of the parks and park reserves in the metropolitan system. Those are shown with the green dots, and you can see there's a wide distribution of those parks throughout the metro area. And also shown in red, in the red dots are state lands. These are state parks, state zoos, and the Minnesota Arboretum. Again, it's the 7 counties, Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Ramsey, Washington, and the Three Rivers Park District, and Scott County, along with the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board and the cities of St. Paul and Bloomington, that own and operate the Metropolitan Regional Park System. This map simply illustrates how all of these parks tie together on a more localized basis. This map illustrates some of the parks in Anoka County, City of St. Paul, and Ramsey County, and various greenways, corridors, and parks, and how they interrelate to one another. The system includes regional parks, 36 units, that provide a wide array of outdoor recreation opportunities. Large regional park reserves between 1,000 and 5,000 acres. There are 10 of those in the metro system. These protect major landscape types and also provide a wide array of outdoor recreational opportunities. There are 22 regional trails, as I mentioned, that link the parks and park reserves together and tie in with local trail systems and local points of interest within the communities. About 200 miles is currently open. There are several million visits per year to the regional trail system. And of those, about over 500,000 are actually used for people who commute to and from work. There are several special recreation features in the metro system, including the Como Zoo, the Como Conservatory, the Nuremberg Floral Gardens, Square Lake, and Silver Lake Parks. This next graph illustrates the growth in the regional park system visitation since it was first established in 1964. And as you can see from this, and this is based on scientific research that is done each year on the use of the park system, it has grown quite appreciably in the last 31 years, from 5 million visits in 1974 to an estimated 30.5 million visits in 2003. Where do the folks come from who utilize the Metropolitan Regional Park System? You can see from this pie chart that nearly 60% are local visits, people from within the host agency's jurisdiction, but over 40% also come from outside the host area jurisdiction. These include individuals from other parts of the metropolitan area, as well as 3.2% from outside the metro area and 3.4% from outside the state of Minnesota. What this illustrates is that about 40% of our use is, again, people that are coming into, for instance, coming into Anoka County to use our parks in Anoka County who are not local residents. Why are state funds needed for the Metropolitan Regional Park System for operations and maintenance? Well, first, Minnesota Statutes 473.351, which was adopted by the legislature in 1985, recognizes that there is this local or this non-local use component to the regional park system. That these parks really do act like state parks in the metropolitan area, and they draw people from a wide, broad geographic area. And state appropriations for operations and maintenance then are intended to pay for these non-local uses of the park system. The state statute adopted in 1985 set a goal for the state to finance 40% of the regional park operations and maintenance, again reflecting on the fact that these are regional parks that act like state parks and that draw people from a wide area. The actual fund appropriations since 1985 have ranged from 10.85% down to, more recently, 4.6% in 2004. The next chart does a little better job of illustrating what the financing has looked like over the last, 18 years since the legislature passed the statute to fund operations and maintenance of the regional system. You can see in the green bar that illustrates the increase in the biennial cost to operate the system. Currently, it costs the 10 regional park agencies about $160 million every 2 years per biennium, or $80 million a year to operate the regional park system. The blue line represents the amount of state funding, and you can see that has remained relatively stable or flat, while the increase in the cost of operating the system has been quite pronounced. If you look, target in and look specifically at the last 4 or 5 years, you can see that the percentage of state funding has dropped since the year 2001 from 7.6%, which was $4.5 million per year, to 2004, which is 4.6%, or $3.3 million per year. For fiscal year 2005, the state appropriation is $3,201,000. That represents a 3% decrease in funding based upon a state across-the-board general fund decrease in funding for 2005. And so today we have about 4.3% of the funding covered by state dollars. The balance of the funds come from local property taxes, and about 20% are from user fees. In 2006, if this bill were adopted and the funding was brought back to the year 2001 funding levels, it would help move us in the right direction and would finance 5.8% of the cost of operating the system. Well, then what are the outcomes of House File 1665? Well, obviously, first off, it increases state funding for regional park operations and maintenance by about $1.2 million per year, and it increases the state general fund support to 5.8% per year. For Anoka County specifically, I'd like to speak to that for just a moment. In the last few years, with a combination of local government aid cuts and cuts to the general fund operations and maintenance grants, we've had many impacts on our system. These have included the closing of our beaches. We've had to remove lifeguards from all of the beaches in Anoka County. We've reduced the scope of our Park Ranger program. We have virtually eliminated our equipment replacement program. We've reduced our mowing schedule, our waste pickup. We've removed many of our portable toilets from the park system. We have vacant maintenance positions. So there have been many, many impacts across the board in our system. What this bill will allow us to do is get back to business as more as usual as we have in the past. We would see increased funding for management of natural resources, for wetland projects, water quality management, restoration of prairies, dealing with exotic species, and more recently the increased surge we've seen in disease tree problems in our parks and our communities. Restoration of our building and facility maintenance programs would be a result of this bill. We would see a reinstatement of our mowing and grounds maintenance services back to a more normal operating level. Restoration of our lifeguard and beach services. I know in Anoka County, I can assure you that if this bill were passed, Anoka County would receive an additional $150,000 per year for the regional parks, and I can assure you that we would be restoring our lifeguard and beach services at our popular beaches such as Lake George Regional Park and Centerville Beach, and that's a very important facet to our operation. We would be able to restore our special events, community gatherings, our programming that we do with our school districts and so forth for youngsters and families. In addition, this would allow us and give us the resources to improve our playground safety and maintenance programs and to enhance our volunteerism and youth programming throughout the parks here in the metropolitan region. And with that, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I thank you for the opportunity to present, and I would stand for any questions that you might have. And we do have some representatives from some of the agencies here this morning as well. So thank you.
There is one piece of information that I'd like to have. If we could get a graph that would show the capital investment improvements over the years, mm-hmm. and then match that minus any maintenance or anything, but actual improvement situations, so sure. Expansion of either new parks or from acquisition or for improvements to those parks, and then match that up with the overall operating costs. I'd like to see if there's a correlation. And my assumption is that we'll see that some of those capital improvements are actually able to help. They'd be going up, but the maintenance may be holding fairly steady because those improvements may be getting us more efficiencies. And we're and less maintenance and that sort of thing. But I'd like to try and see those correlations, because we get into arguments all the time as to, you know, what's the more we do to these parks, the more we have and so forth, the more it seems to continue to cost to operate them. And I think it maybe some type of relationship between that may dispel some of that.
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to work with the staff of the Metropolitan Council to get that information to you through Representative Hackbar. Be happy to do that. Thank you.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed that that your funding, your total budget has increased in 2001. You were nearly $60 million, and in 2006 you're projecting $77 million. It's about a 28-29% increase. And I think, Mr. Chairman, the question you asked may have a bearing on this. What are the major cost drivers in your expenses going up at that rate over a few years?
Well, Mr. Chairman and committee members, it's difficult for me to speak for the whole system because I only represent one agency. I will tell you that in Anoka County, we have not seen a 20% increase in our operating costs for our system. It's been more in the range of 3-4%. It's been fairly conservative. I could only speculate that a lot of those costs, for instance, I know in the city of Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Park Board and St. Paul Park Boards right now are dealing with quite an extensive problem with Oakville disease and Dutch Elm disease. I believe I read something earlier, Minneapolis Park Board is expected to spend about $10 million this year alone on removing elm trees from the city. So I think part of these costs may be some of those kinds of events that are occurring that kind of throw these numbers maybe into a little higher level than might be reflected just based on normal operations. I could do a little bit more research on that, committee members, and provide that information to you on specifically where those costs are increasing. But I think it's safe to say that it's probably in a variety of different areas. And of course, some of it is just reflective of inflation as well as increased use of the park system. We are seeing a corresponding increase in the usage of the park system. It's growing very rapidly, and so it's probably a combination of various factors.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Van der Linde, I looked at that, and I can understand you're about during that time period, you went from about 29.5 million visitors in 2000 to about a million more now, and it looks like your total operating budgets are going up, clicking up about $2.5-3 million a year. So it was just my question with that. My next question, you said you funded about 20% user fees. What are those?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, user fees are things like gate entry fees for vehicle permits, okay, picnic shelter fees, camping fees, meeting facility fees, both kinds of things. That constitutes, I think, most of the typical fees that you would see in the use of a park system.
Okay. In Mr. Chairman and Mr. Van der Linde, then you indicated the majority of it comes from the property taxes in the area?
That's correct.
So you'd have about 20% user fees, and then you take out the state funding. Have you had a bonding request in the Capital Investment Committee? Do you have anything in there for...
Yes, there is. Mr. Chairman, committee members, there was actually a bill that in the House was sponsored by Representative Tinglestad. That was for $10.5 million in capital bonding for the regional park system. The amount that's being discussed now in the Conference Committee on Capital Investment is a $7 million bill between the House and Senate for the Metropolitan Regional Park System.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other question, Representative Junkie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe some education. I'm not out to pick a fight or anything with anyone. I just want some information. I see since 1974 we have the Metropolitan Parks Act, and now we get anywhere, historically they've gotten anywhere from 4-7% of their funding from the state. And then the witness was talking about things that are near and dear, I think, to all of us in outstate Minnesota, too, the LGA cuts and how you don't have lifeguards and your maintenance is down, all these things. These are exactly the same things that are going on with our parks
out in rural parts of the state, too. We don't have lifeguards on our county beaches anymore, and we don't have... Mr. Chair, why just some history. Why are we funding metropolitan parks, and do we do a similar funding stream, or have we ever considered it for our rural regional parks, too? And I just really want some education on this, because the same things he's talking about are exactly the same things that are going on in our major parks out there, where we have camping and beaches and everything else too, and we're lacking funding also.
The Representative Junkie, I think one of the answers, as I've looked into this question, is that we do not have a good definition for rural regional parks. And there are many parks in the metropolitan area that are not regional parks, that don't get state assistance, that are actually locally funded. And so it's a matter of trying to get that separation. And I know that there was some effort this past biennium to try and provide some information to lead us in the direction of getting something established for rural regional parks. I think that we need to be working on establishing a rural regional park system in statute, very similar to how we have metropolitan regional park system, then you'd be able to have an apples to apples comparison. Where right now it's so scattered. Nobody. We just had a significant inventory taken by the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources (LCMR) just to try and get a handle on what may be out there in rural Minnesota that would qualify as a regional park versus a local park. And I know that you mentioned it in your testimony, but some of the criteria that you use to establish a metro regional park versus a metro local park, and what's the difference between what makes a regional park? And I know you covered it, but maybe just cover it one more time.
Chairman, committee members, the metropolitan regional park system does have criteria in place that need to be met in order for a park to be considered a regional park. First and foremost, the area needs to be at least 200 acres in size. There have been some rare occurrences when that number has gone down and they allowed some units in that are closer to about 100 acres, but that is the exception and not the rule. Generally speaking, those smaller parks, 100 to 200 acres, have had to have had some particularly unique attribute that draws people from a large geographic area. But generally speaking, they have to be a minimum of 200 acres in size. Secondarily, those parks, to be considered a regional park, need to have at least 40% of their use coming from outside of the host agency's jurisdiction. So for a park to be considered regional in Anoka County, at least 40% of the use has to be coming from greater Minnesota or other counties within the metropolitan area. If those criteria are met and the focus of that park is around outdoor recreation, based activities such as swimming, fishing, hiking, camping, and those kinds of things, and not ball fields. Those are really relegated to the local cities. Then the Metropolitan Council would be open to considering the inclusion of a park that would meet those criteria in the regional system.
I think there was at one point an evaluation between most state parks are in rural Minnesota and the Metropolitan didn't have state parks, and so they tried to make some type of balance there also. The frustration I think we had in the survey is discovering that people that actually use state parks very often are not the rural people. It's metropolitan people that are coming into the rural area that's using the state parks. And so even though we're giving credit to the rural area of having state parks, so therefore we're kind of covering your park needs, that's not who's being serviced. It's actually people from the metropolitan area that's utilizing most of that service. So from a funding standpoint, it seems to be disproportionate right now, but attempts to work on it have not been successful so far. So I think you need to pick the fight. Any other questions that members may have? Presentation. I would like to ask about, and this actually is more of a parochial issue from my own edification, and that's, I know that there's been in the plans to continue the trail system from South St. Paul and down through Dakota County, and I think even further south. And I wonder if we could get an update as to what is happening with that trail system.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, if I may, I'd like to ask Steve Sullivan to step down and respond to that question. Steve is the Director of Parks and Recreation for Dakota County, and he's more familiar with that particular topic, so I'll yield to Steve.
Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Steve Sullivan. I'm the Director of Parks in Dakota County. The trail that Chair Osmond is referring to runs approximately 19 miles from Hastings to the city of South St. Paul. It currently has an approved master plan, and in regards to what is built, the city of South St. Paul has built approximately 5 miles of trail that is serving the public currently. There's also, City of South St. Paul's also has within the bonding bill I believe it's called Port Crosby, which will support another portion of that trail. And then there's a T21 grant that has been approved in year 2000, either 6 or 7, that would provide a connection from Spring Lake Park Reserve, which is approximately 3 miles upstream of Hastings, and connect to the Hastings Trail system that runs along their Levy Park and into their downtown. That's what's in store in the near future in terms of implementation of the trail. There are some planning efforts that are occurring within Ember Grove as a result of some MnDOT projects, and that is the extent of the work that's currently being done on the Mississippi River Regional Trail.
Yeah, appreciate that update. If Representative Kahn is here, she'd probably be asking, I guess I need a little information too with regard to Minneapolis, and there's a trail system that she has been interested in that's, I think they call it the Ring Trail, or that goes from the lakes, and then there's a section through northern part of Minneapolis that's not connected. Is that part of the regional or the metro regional trail system, or is that something that's just within the city of Minneapolis?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Kirk Peterson with Rice, Michaels, and Walther. We represent the Minneapolis Park Board. I think, Mr. Chairman, you're referring to the Grand Rounds system.
Yes, that's it.
Right, which is part of the national scenic byway system. Most of that system, it's segmented into 7 different unique geographical or historic systems, and it does make a ring of trails, paths, bikeways, virtually all the way around the city of Minneapolis. Most of that system is contained within the regional park system. There's a small section up in the northeast part of Minneapolis. You're coming in on 35 north, and you look over and you see the Home Depot and that kind of whole area into there. That northeast Minneapolis section, for some reason, is not included in the metro regional park system at this time. And so even though we have received money from the Met Council, from the state, to work on those projects, we haven't been able to use it to develop that system. So we are in the process of finding out how we can best complete that segment of trail through the communities and through the local area to connect it from basically about by a golf course down to the East Mississippi Parkway.
Are you describing to me a designation problem? It's just not. You said it's not designated as metro regional trails, and if that's the case, who has that designation? Who makes that designation? The Metropolitan Council or the state legislature?
Mr. Chairman, that'd be the Met Council that would do that, and we're working with them to make sure we meet their criteria on that.
Okay, we may want to talk about. We might have some encouraging language that might help them on that effort. So. Any other questions, members? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Hackbarth, do you have anything additional on that bill?
Up.
On six, are there, is there anyone else that wants to testify for or against House File 1665? Okay, House File 1665 be laid open for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill. Representative Hackbarth, House File 1904.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move House File 1904 to bring it before us. And members, this is not a department bill. It's not a governor's proposal. This was an idea that was brought to me by a constituent in my district, and I have to say I agree with it. We'll have my constituent give a little testimony here, but what this does, members, is increase the license fees on boats. Many of the boats' license fees have not been increased since 1981. And what I'm doing in the bill is doubling the fees that have not been raised since 1981. For example, a boat under 17 feet is currently $12 for 3 years, and I would raise it to $24 for 3 years. And many of these fees have been raised back in 1999. We doubled those fees we raised them 50% at that time in 1999. And what this bill would do would raise once we raised in 99 an additional 50%. And also in the bill at the very end, we create a dedicated fund within the water rec account to put these funds that are raised by this bill into a dedicated fund that would go strictly for boat access and maintenance and acquisition and rehabilitation of our public boating access. So that pretty much sums up the bill. And I have Mr. Dave Overland. Maybe many members might recognize him. And he's going to give a little testimony on the bill.
Welcome to the committee. I knew I recognized this idea from somewhere. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Representative. My name is Dave Overland. This issue came up at the fishing roundtable this winter, and it had a huge amount of support. So I decided to ask, Representative Ackbarth about submitting a bill to increase the fees. The public access is, first of all, Minnesota is one of the highest per capita boat ownerships in the nation. One of the, and there's an awful lot of people that come into Minnesota that use our public access as tourists and such. And our public accesses, many of which are in horrible shape. Some of them are almost to the point of limiting access to public waters. I tried to launch my 16-foot fishing boat on the north end of Mille Lacs at the Wellfoot Access, beautiful public access. And when I pushed the boat off of the trailer, it wouldn't move in the water because the sand had filled in the access. And this is the case at various public accesses around the state. So. In talking to the people at the roundtable and at the various groups after that, a lot of them had concerns about fee increases, costs, and stuff. But every one of them said, as long as the money went specifically to fixing public accesses, they supported it. Some of the groups that I've talked to are here today, and if you want a question about it, you can. But I think it's very important that we get these accesses in shape and so that people can use them.
Okay. Questions from members? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to commend Representative Hackbarth for bringing forth this legislation that I think is going to enhance the integrity of our lakes. But that said, I have another concern that this bill indirectly affects, and that is the need to do something about the proliferation of our invasive species, zebra mussel, curly-leaf pondweed, milfoil. And I've chatted with Representative Hackbarth about this, and he feels that this could free up some money to deal with that. But I want to emphasize that we need to find more funding for this. I want those boats that are going to be with the improved access of the lakes to have lakes that they will be able to freely traverse across. Free of the invasive species that have been harming our lakes. So, while I again commend the Representative Hackbarth for bringing this forward, I think that with the choking lakes that we have, particularly in central Minnesota, we need to seriously address the problem of what to do about these species.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this question would be for Director Martinson, if she could come up for a second.
Thanks.
Get her on the Hudson. Get her in the frying pan for a minute.
Burning barrel,
yes. Director Martinson, Mr. Chairman, would this what part of this increased fee would the DNR get for administrative use, if any? And would this money be used to mitigate the power loading problem at almost every site now? And we've talked about power loading in this committee before. Would this money be used to mitigate that? And the third part of the question, I guess maybe it's the second part, is would there be more emphasis on acquiring new sites or fixing old sites? Do you follow all those questions? Maybe I didn't get them in the right order.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Lori Martinson. I'm the director for the Division of Trails and Waterways. It's been since 1989 the last appropriation increase for public accesses. So it's been quite a while, and over that time we've stopped providing a number of services at the public accesses, including toilets. That's a big concern for me, is that we need to have sanitation facilities, especially at those sites that are used, have a high rate of use. Docks are another facility that we stop providing at certain facilities just because we don't have the funds to provide for them. Those would help enhance boat launching. Power loading is certainly of significance. Our most recent study in the Brainerd Lakes area shows that the average size of boat is 18 feet with an average horsepower of 114. What's happening, I think we talked about this in committee when I gave testimony earlier, is that the props as folks are power loading, using the engines to get up onto the up onto their trailers, they create a pile behind the boat of sand and rock, and then when the boats are launching, subsequent boats are launching, they back up against that. So extending the ramps out into the lake so that we have a solid base for these boats as they're power loading is one way to address that. This money could be used for that. Certainly, acquisition is important. Additionally, addressing a lot of these accesses were built before we were paying attention to restoring native shoreline, preserving native habitat on our public access sites. We have work to do to go back and fix some of the older sites. I think that's very important. Two years ago, we restored a spot in southwestern Minnesota with fisheries staff so with a combination AMA and public access. We restored 7 acres of native prairie. It looks beautiful. It's a beautiful access, but that takes money and time and effort. Additionally, the canoe and boating program, there's 26 canoe and boating routes, over 3,000 miles of routes, and we have very few facilities there, let alone gauging stations and things to give to canoers and boaters who want to use those routes so they know it's safe for them to use. Did that answer your list of questions?
Administration.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, some of the funds would be used for administration as well. One of the things that we foresee is the need for a master plan regarding public accesses so we can determine when we know we have enough and where we're going.
Director, with regard to as we're getting more watercraft out there, we've seen some of the problems we've had with regard to enforcement issues. And is this money then available for additional enforcement if we dedicate it to this specific account?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't have enforcement listed as one of the items that it would cover.
It's, I think it's something you may want to consider or take a look at, see if there's, because as we're looking at more of these boats, not only getting them onto the water and getting good access, it's also getting them to behave well out there while they're out there, and enforcement certainly helps to do that. I have a little concern with a couple of issues. Because I know across the board raising of the fee is the approach that you've taken, but I was wondering if Mr. Oberlein could come back. Do you have any ideas to what the sense would be of the stakeholders with regard to increasing it to not only just the accesses but also to enforcement? Is there, would that be received or good or bad or indifferent? Or?
Mr. Chairman,
no idea.
Representatives, I haven't asked that specific question. Typically, people... I can't answer that truthfully.
Okay.
Typically, people, the hunters and anglers that I have talked to, have been very supportive of enforcement. That enforcement is very important to the hunters and anglers. So, I would have to say they probably would support it, but I can't answer that truthfully.
The other question I have is with regard to, because it's across the board increases. And using it for access points and or enforcement, the non-motorized canoe doesn't really fit in that category to me because they don't use an access normally. They whether it's a good access or a bad access, they get the canoe in. And I'm wondering as to Representative Hackbarth, if there's, do you think it's important that we raise all of them or can we make some discernment between some of these? For example, a canoe really is the most environmentally benign type of recreation. It seems to me that holding its cost down as much as possible would be a good thing to do. I don't know if you're interested in that.
And Mr. Chairman, I did think of that when I put this bill together, but the canoes and the kayaks, the rowing shells, the sailboats, etc., the paddle boats, they haven't been raised since 1981. And I thought I'd include them because they're at $7 for 3 years right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought 1981, I thought maybe they'd be due for an increase.
Okay. And these 16-foot fishing boat, as it goes up to $24, but then an 18-foot runabout, which is significantly different with regard to access needs and so forth, it's only $3 more in. I'm wondering if there's what thought you have in those price differences.
Well, Mr. Chairman, these are based on increases that we did in 1999. The ones that haven't been raised since 1981, I doubled. And in 1999, we raised all of them 50% that are on the sheet. And I'm just raising them another 50%. So essentially, they will have all been doubled since 1981. So these are figures that, not that I came up with, but it's just a doubling of all of the fees since 1981. Mm-hmm. So I'm certainly open to adjusting those, Mr. Chairman, but I just wanted to make it simple.
I'm interested in having that discussion, especially with DNR at some point also, because it seems to me a 16-foot fishing boat, we're not going to have the power loading problem that we have with the runabouts and the larger boats. It just seems to me that the powers, once you get up to the larger motors, are causing more difficulty. There's more maintenance to the facilities. Therefore, they should. And $3 difference to me just doesn't seem to be quite adequate. So I'm thinking maybe we should appreciate your willingness to take a look at that.
Certainly,
if we get better
that.
Educated on this, we might want to make some. Little differences as to how the original evaluations came about and how we carry that forward in today's environment. They didn't have those 20 years ago. They didn't have the same problems that we have today with many of our motorized equipment especially.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to point out on the chart that I passed out, if you compare to other states, I think with this raise we're pretty comparable. We'll be pretty comparable. We're pretty cheap right now.
Yeah. Are there other questions right now? Representative Junkie.
I must have missed it early, and I apologize. How much would this raise in its present form? How many dollars?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, I don't have a fiscal note. I'm not sure what it would be.
Does our fiscal staff have any idea?
I believe that we're going to have DNR come down and give some testimony on the bill. Any other questions of Mr. Overland?
No.
Okay.
As he's approaching, Mr. Chair, maybe I can also point out the other question I had Representative Ertl brought up on the invasive species. I agree that we need to hire more summer interns. We need to have them out there. I think that's a real important part of our accesses now because he's right. Our central Minnesota and west central Minnesota lakes are getting hit pretty hard right now, too. And I know you had, Representative Hackbar, said that some of that money should be freed up if we have extra money for accesses that's now coming out of the current license fees, but I'd like a little more specifics on that from the department. How much money will be freed up? I'd like to get a commitment from them that there will be money freed up, and if not, then, you know, like we're talking about enforcement and other things, you know, I don't want to necessarily hook it onto your list here, but if we're not getting a commitment to free up money and add it to it, then I feel like we have to do something in language to make sure it's there. And Mr. Chair, I also agree with your canoe thing. I keep picturing these canoes just kind of laying on the shore by the lake, and, you know, and those are the people, we'll get the most calls from canoe owners, I think. The big boat folks understand it takes money and launches and concrete and other things, but the canoe folks, I don't think, understand that or want to do that. So I think you're right on the mark there.
There's a lot of canoes that are seen out there that they're only there for that one weekend when the grandkids have to come up for something. So
we can get the dollar amount estimate?
Mr. Chairman, before we started that, I would like to mention, too, about this. I think it's over in Minneapolis. They want to build some kind of a kayak park on the Mississippi River. And right now they're only paying $7. And they want to get some money from the state in order to get that kayak park built. I think we might have to increase your fees.
Not off my canoe. Just kidding. Would you have some testimony for us? Let me ask.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Kim Elverum, Boat and Water Safety Coordinator. We did a draft preliminary note on this bill, and I think it's like $2.9 million per year in a full fiscal year that it would raise, roughly. The first year, if it went into effect on the 1st of January 2006, it would be about $2.5 million because it doesn't encompass the whole fiscal year. So anywhere, it's 2.9 for a full fiscal year would be a good rough estimate for you.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up, what's our current collections?
It depends on which year it is. There's three odd years, so it runs between 3.5 to 4.2. I don't know. I don't have the fund statement in front of me, but something like that anyway that we collect total. So
thank you.
One of the things I may point out, Mr. Chairman, you were talking about canoes, and I was mentioning this to Ms. Martinson, is that the canoes and the kayaks both use the canoe and boating route program, and that's one of the programs that she had discussed before that this would be helping funding, so you might want to keep that in mind, because we do have, 26 canoe and boating routes in the state, and canoeing is becoming, you know, the river-type canoeing, flat-water-type canoeing, and river canoeing are becoming popular, so...
All right, and Representative Peterson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to Mr. Overland or to Chairman Hackbarth, you mentioned the fishing round table when you gave your testimony. I'm wondering where did, in following Representative Erdahl and Representative Junkie's concerns about exotic species, where in the Fishing Roundtable's recommendations to the exotic species control, specifically with the 153 lakes with Eurasian water milfoil, the 560 lakes with curly leaf pondweed, and the two inland lakes that have zebra mussels right now. Where did that score, if you have a formal score table on in terms of what the roundtable suggests? Because I think if you're going to get the opportunity to raise fees, and it's been since 1981, it'd be a very unwise thing, in my opinion, to miss an opportunity to dedicate a significant portion, like the state of Maine does, where they have one lake with Eurasian water milfoil and one lake with curly leaf pondweed, because they spend $1.5 million a year on prevention in Maine. I think we're in a state in Minnesota where we're hopeful that it doesn't spread. And the DNR did testify earlier this session that each ecological services spends a significant amount of money on these, specifically on the lake in the Brainerd area, on making sure zebra mussels don't get out of it. So I'm just wondering, what's the Fishing Roundtable's priority when it comes to exotic species? Because you know, we're getting hammered in southwestern and west central Minnesota with these exotics, and you know, when agencies are spread too thin, then we cross a threshold with distribution of the exotics, and one way to distribute them, reading the Lakes Association reporter, is the access points. So I'm not for shutting down any access points philosophically, but I'm not for watching decent lakes in Minnesota get infested with exotics when we have an opportunity with this bill potentially to get some money for exotic control. I'm just wondering where the fishing roundtable is on exotic species.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, I guess I can't. Maybe you misunderstood me. I'm not here to represent the fishing roundtable. I said it was brought up at the
roundtable.
And at the roundtable, there was much discussion about exotics. I can't say one way or another how they stood on fees on exotics. The anglers that I have talked to about this specific issue are supportive of stopping exotics, but they'd like to see and pay for a comprehensive plan that has a hope of stopping exotics, not just throw more money at a problem that has no hope of doing any good. So I guess that would be the pushback. There, some of the spread of exotics is caused by the destruction of natural vegetation around docks and swimming beaches. Some of the spread of exotics is caused by fertilizer and runoff from lawns into lakes. So I guess if you wanted to be fair about that, you would put a sticker on all docks and public waters as well as boats if you wanted to, were really interested in spending money on exotics. So I guess that would be my input. And I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. If we're talking about a significant amount of money and we've got a significant problem growing, yes, I'm not against putting more on people who use lakes other than just boat owners. I mean, yeah, that's a good point. But I think this is a vehicle that should include exotics, not just access points.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hackbarth, do we have any specific studies then that detail the extent of the problem of the access site, what the deferred maintenance has been, where the problem sites are, what the costs are? And if we're going to be dealing with this kind of money, I'd like to see some specific information. Then just following up on what's been discussed, I get the sense that a lot of it comes from the bigger boats that are at these access sites. Now, I guess I'd like to see if we're going to continue with this fee route, that it be directed more specifically to the cause of the problem than not. I'm not sure the bill is oriented sufficiently in that direction. But again, I would like to see more specific information on where the public access site problems are, what caused the problem, and what the plan is to resolve them, and what that would cost.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, there's getting to be more and more of the bigger boats that are doing the power loading. That is creating a problem. But also our public accesses are in disrepair. And as Ms. Martinson talked about earlier, we're not putting the restroom facilities out there. We're cutting back in certain areas. We're not doing the maintenance on the public accesses that we have now. There's a lot of 16-foot fishing boats, 14-foot fishing boats that are still using these public accesses, and they would like to see a decent public access when they go there, too. So I don't think we should exclude them from the increase. The smaller boats haven't had the increase since 90 or 81, so I think we need to include them. But I think the power boats, the bigger power boats, which we're getting more and more of all the time, are really creating a problem at the public accesses. And I think we need this to mitigate those things. But as far as having some statistics, I think maybe the DNR might have something. I don't know. I haven't talked to them. Like I said earlier, this is not a department bill, and it's not a governor's proposal. I'm doing this for Mr. Overland, and I believe in it, too.
Representative Hackbarth, regards the power loading issue, has there been any discussion, if you're aware of, prohibiting power boating or power loading unless it's specifically authorized, or some way to try and hold down on this damage? We hit snowmobiles when they were causing problems. We hit, you know, ATVers and they're causing problems. Why aren't we doing something about the power boats?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we'd have to have specific accesses for these, because I think this is how they're recommended to be loaded onto the trailer. I haven't heard of anyone that's trying to restrict it or put a stop to power loading, but you have to power load some of these boats now. That's just the way you have to do it. Maybe Mr. Oberlin can speak to that issue too.
Mr. Oberlin?
Chairman, yes, that's correct. Some of the boats I have, I actually have two boats for that reason. I have a 21-foot fiberglass boat that I keep in a slip that at a resort that I do not take to accesses for that reason. The other boat I have is a 16-foot aluminum boat that I do take to various lakes, and I actually found myself out on Mille Lacs because of a launching problem with my small boat in a pretty heavy wind one day, and I wish I would have had my bigger boat, but I couldn't launch it. It was late in the fall, and a lot of the resorts were closed. So, but it's even a problem with the smaller boats at a lot of these accesses. Like I said, they're filled in with sand, so. So it is a two-part problem. The big boats do have to be power loaded. There's no way you can crank them up. My fiberglass boat weighs over 2,000 pounds. You have to drive it on the trailer. And it requires a deep harbor, and most of the time I pay at resorts launch it. But there are just times where you can't or you shouldn't have to. I mean, that's restricting public access to lakes. That's true. You need to drive those big boats on.
Mr. Overland, does the boat type examples we have for licensure doesn't take that into account? Should there be a different fee for power loading boats?
Mr. Chairman, it's higher for the bigger boats. I guess that's the difference.
If they're causing a problem,
well,
a good portion of it.
But the yes, you're correct. But the facilities and all the other things related to public access, everybody uses the canoes, the kayakers. Everybody uses those facilities. So the funds for power loading, there was a way to separate that out and just charge the bigger boats for that. I guess I would support that, but I don't know how you would do that. But everybody uses the facilities, I guess, would be my response to that. So, and that's a big share of the cost. Dredging out these public accesses, I don't suspect that's very much. But the parking lots and environmental concerns and stuff is a big share of their costs. And they're
getting dredged out. It's just by power loading. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the edification of committee members, did some checking, and DNR spends about $1.2 million a year combating invasive species, about $4.5 million now being spent a year on water access improvements, and there will be another $160,000 more for invasive species if the current budget is passed.
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the sheet that you handed out to us, Chairman Hackworth, on the bottom it says, the asterisk says all states convert to 3-year cycle for this charge. Anyway, what I'm wondering, invasive species surcharge are not included, I know, in your fees. Do we have an invasive species surcharge now? And what is it?
Included in the registration? $5. Okay. DNR is telling me $5.
Okay. Thank you.
Included in the fee now.
Are there any other questions? Okay, and I think we had testimony from DNR on this is not a DNR proposal.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, we do have one more person that would like to testify, Mr. Schneider.
Very good.
I'd say if you
put it on, yeah.
and Mr. Thompson would like to say something, too. He came quite a ways.
Go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm slipping a little. When I first moved, they call it canalith, and the doctors can't seem to make any headway on it, so I was a little woozy from that. My name is Frank Schneider. I'm a resident of St. Paul. I'm an old one. I've been fishing most of my life. I'm 86. I belong to almost every major fishing group in the state. I'm either a member or a life member. I'm past president of Muskies, Inc. I helped build the organization. I started Minnesota Sport Fishing Congress. I'm still president there. We haven't been too active. But you're considering a bill that's going to raise the fee, and I think it's a user's fee, and that's why I'm for it, of the boats. For instance, the boats that we learned, that I learned on, back in the early 30s, they were planks, and they leaked. The car I learned to drive when I was when I first learned to drive was a Model T or Model something, and that had four or five shift levers and three pedals. Now our cars have improved, our highways have improved. We don't drive on the kind of highways we had back in the 30s. We drive on good ones. Our street funds pay for that. Same thing applies to our boats. The boats that I learned to use way back in there, 33, 34, when I was in high school, they're not like that anymore. Right now, if you go out and spend some money for a boat, if you get a bass boat, what we call a bass boat, if you get a Triton, get a Stratos like I have, or a Ranger, you're going to spend from $30,000 to over $40,000 if you get it with all the toys. That's a lot of money. That's more than you spend for a car. And I think you'd get a hell of a lot more for your money right there in that boat. Now, it probably costs some families a little more than others. My family's going to pay for it. My children, myself, and my grandchildren, the boats that they have, we keep up. Our cabin is up on Lake Vermilion, up out of Cook. We've owned a cabin now for 40-some years. We've been up there for six. We have two bass boats. We have, I'm talking about what the family has up there. We have a power, a runabout that my oldest son has. He's an attorney. He found out early in life he didn't want to work for a living. We have a kayak. We have a canoe. We have two small aluminum boats that we use for hunting. We can still fish with them. We prefer to fish with the big boat. So it's going to cost my family some money. We're all in favor of that. It's a user's fee. Representative Hackbart came up with, I thought, a real clean bill. We're going to raise the fees on those who use the boats and then dedicate it to our access program. The state has spent some real good dollars and created accesses on many, many lakes. Thank God they did. But they haven't been able to keep those things in good shape. Talking about power boats creating a problem with the sand and stuff in the lake. You got to remember this. The only place that happens is where they put the access in on a real shallow end of that lake because nobody wanted that damn stuff. Otherwise, we couldn't afford it. So, as far as I'm concerned, it isn't the length of boat. You can put a 15... they're out there right now, a 15-foot or a 16-foot boat with a 200-horse motor. So it isn't the length that's causing the problem. And with the number of these bigger bass boats that we have in our state, we have to have a decent place to put them in and take them out, and that includes mine. You can't take and drag these boats, I don't care if they're aluminum or if they're fiber. You can't drag them across some of these accesses. You just can't. You're going to ruin the boat. We got too damn much money invested in it. And I want to thank Representative Hackbart for bringing this up. There isn't a single group that I'm involved in that I know is not in favor of some sort of a decent raise as long as it's dedicated to the access program. I'm not saying we don't need a bill of some kind to help with the wrong kinds of weeds are coming into the state, or with this different kind of what do they call it? Whatever it is that's coming into our waters. But that should be a separate bill. Let's keep this one nice and clean. Let's get it out. Take the dollars we're going to get. The state will have to have a few dollars to handle it. There's no question about that. And if we have to, I wouldn't be averse to giving a small part of it to our conservation people, the officers. I'm not against that. What we need is good access so I can get my boat in and out. What we need is a good access program. And this is the committee that's going to have to do it. Now, I used to be over here a lot, and back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and first part of the 90s, back when Willard Munger and John Rose chaired the committee, and I was always so damn proud of this committee. We had some good bills came out of here. Then 6 years ago, I fell on my head way up in Canada into solid rock, and my balance isn't so good. And I've been fishing actively since before World War II, and don't take our fun away from us. That's all parts we needed.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Dave Thompson. I own Fisherman's Village Resort in Otter Tail County, and I'm here as part of the Citizen Oversight Committee for the Game and Fish Fund. I'm a volunteer on this committee and been asked to serve by DNR for about the past 4 years, I believe. A couple of years ago, Dennis Osmondson, the then director of Trails and Waterways, came to our committee and asked us to look into this issue of public accesses and the lack of funding, and it highlighted it for me at that time. Interestingly enough, just prior to that, I was talking to my local Trails and Waterways person about getting some trash cans at my access, because my access is used by canoers and inner tubers, because I'm on the Otter Tail River as well. The trash problem was terrible, and I got a 3-hour slide presentation from my local access person about how little money they actually get and where they get to spend it. In fact, the local sportsman's group had to buy a tractor and a loader for the DNR to use so they could remove the concrete planks and repair an access. As part of the Citizen Oversight Committee, I get to see every year where DNR spends their money, and my assignment as a citizen is to make sure that the money's spent where we'd like to have it. The problem they face is just what we've talked about here this morning, is that every time there's a fee increase, it gets taken and put into other things that it was never notified to the voters and the users that it was going to be used for. That's why when I wrote a report on this for the legislative committee, I asked it to be specifically spent on accesses. Invasive species already has a tax on boat registration. Most people who buy a boat registration don't realize where all the money goes, but a very small portion of it actually is the boat registration. The rest of it is fees that have been tacked on. The initial invasive species fee, I believe, was only for a couple of years, and it's been extended pretty much permanently, and it could be raised, but that should not be part of this bill. The access program is in desperate need of improvements. As far addressing the canoe part of it, I'm on the Otter Tail River. There are two accesses between me and between Fergus Falls and my resort, and those accesses hardly get used because there's a bridge that canoers and tubers have to go through, and there's bolts hanging down, and when water's high, someone could get hurt. They don't have the money to get those fixed, so the accesses don't get utilized, but they were built. They just sit there empty. One of the things that DNR desperately needs to do to fix this power loading problem is there's a bladder system that they can purchase that they can put out in an access and dry it out, work on it so none of the silt is put back into the lake while they're working on it. They can extend these concrete planks out further to prevent the power loading damage, but those systems cost $25,000 to $30,000 for one. They'd like to purchase one and get to work on this. Without this funding increase, they cannot buy that. They can't buy toilets. They can't buy handicapped toilets. They can't buy docks. My local sportsmen's clubs supply docks. They pay for lights and the electricity to run the lights at different public accesses. Those dollars could go to other things that DNR doesn't need to pay for, that the local sportsmen groups could easily pay for, extra docks on smaller lakes and that sort of thing. Instead, they're paying for things that all boaters and all recreational users should use. Like I said, inner tubing is a huge activity on my lake, yet those inner tubers pay absolutely no fee to use that access, but they park in it, they throw their trash in it, and they do other things there because there's no restrooms. And it's desperately important that this get funded, that it get dedicated exactly to where we want it funded to. If the environmental species needs additional funding, then that group should come and ask for a fee increase on the invasive species tax that's already on the boat registration. I have a report that I wrote for the committee a couple of years ago, and I can easily provide it for the committee that has all this data in it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Any further comments, Chairman Hackworth, on
the bill? No. Madam Chairman, I think that concludes testimony, and I think we know how important this is. We really need the help on our public accesses. They're kind of falling apart out there, and I think this will go a long way to get them repaired.
Okay, and then we will not take a vote on this. It will be rolled over for possible inclusion in the finance omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, members.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned.